before we start the show, I have something to ask you. I want you to know that people are starting to pay attention to the podcast. Some of these people are a pretty big deal in our little world. We were approached by a very cool independent podcast network. I can't say which one, but I can tell you that it rhymes with Schmanitoland. They asked us if we would be interested in a cross promo, and obviously we said yes. The only thing is, our download numbers aren't where they need to be. So we've had to shelve this opportunity until our numbers rise by a measly few thousand downloads. So share the podcast. Please tell your friends. Rent out a billboard in Sudbury advertising us. Do whatever you can to get our weird conversations about terrible columnists in Canada to people that would be interested in it. Thank you so much. Okay, now we're going to do the show.
Hey, what's up? Big shiny takers, big shiny fakers, big shiny tokers. This is Jeremy, here with another round of the world's only anti-free speech podcast. Joining me, as always, are my pals Pickle Rick.
Hello, hello.
And Mario Gecko.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going. By the time this episode airs, I'm going to be frantically moving to Calgary in the middle of a pandemic. Anyways, we are joined by a very special guest today, Big Shiny Takes Institute senior legal analyst, and that is Alex from House of Decline. Alex, how are you doing?
Good. Also, I would like to do a call to action for my podcast. It's a big piece of bullshit. You should listen to it sometimes. It's called House of Decline. House is spelled H-A-U-S in a counterintuitive way. Nah, I shouldn't play the promotion game, but it's good to be on Big Shiny Takes. I love you guys. I love it when you read columns and you mock the sick freaks of Canadian FOP media. Of Canadian right-wing FOP media, and I feel like we're about to get into some good right-wing FOPs today.
I'm glad that you also played the promotion game on this one. Honestly, everyone should listen to House of Decline.
We're a hardcore Calvinist podcast. If you're into, like, talking about the loom of fate and how we're merely strands on God's cruel and immortal wheel of where that is actually a loom, we're just spiraling towards an infinity of chaos, and we are lost adrift in this universe. So that's kind of what you guys cover, too, as well. So there's some environmental overlap there.
Yeah, and we also brought you on because today we're going to talk about a couple of lawyers, am I right?
I am not a lawyer, and I cannot give legal advice. I want to preface that. I'm going to say that three times. I'm not a lawyer, and I cannot give legal advice. I'm not a lawyer, and I cannot give legal advice. I'm not a lawyer, and I cannot give legal advice. In fact, I did not pay my dues, and my license has been suspended. Woo! So I really can't give legal advice. That shit is not happening. But what I can do is speculate for entertainment purposes, so that's what I will do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what you're here for.
But don't take any interpretation I have of any constitutional thing seriously at all. If you do, you will be liable in court for being a fucking chode.
What are they going to do, disbar you?
come for me. No, you could go to fucking jail for practicing law without a license. And they got me on the books of the Law Society. I ain't escaping those freaks. They're coming for me on their, I don't know what they ride, Segways, I guess, you know, the law police.
But we're here to talk about two people who are, in fact, lawyers. And although you are no longer a lawyer, I think we appreciate your expertise in legal matters.
There is a particular type of flashy, obnoxious lawyer pundit. We're here to talk about two people who are the Canadian representations of this pundit class, this specific brand of pundit class. That is a guy by the name of Howard Levitt. His column made the rounds on Twitter recently for suggesting that people are engaged in time theft, which...
Time theft.
From working at home, right? They're not working enough. But Time theft also sounds like a really cool concept from like a Philip K. Dick novel.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
It makes me think of the movie Time Bandits by Terry Gilliam. You know, what with the little people and the child, and they go through time. And Sean Connery, who is he in that movie? Is he Agamemnon? Yeah, Sean Connery's Agamemnon. It's a really good movie. Time theft
sounds like the premise of a terrible '80s movie, like starring Patrick Swayze.
Time thieves. Well, there's Time Cop, so there logically are time thieves.
That is true. But so we're talking about Howard Levitt, and we're also a bit later going to talk about Alex's arch nemesis, Bruce Pardee of Queen's University. You know, Levitt, you should definitely Google a picture of what he looks like. Because I think it's I feel like it's one of those things where you have to see what the person looks like for their words to have like the maximum impact.
Oh man, he looks like just like dorky square version, an even dorkier, more square version of Stephen Colbert.
I thought you were gonna say Eric.
It's really, really disrespectful. Oh man, Howard that first Levitt? Picture with the floral. Oh no, it's a shirt with a bunch of animals on it. Oh boy,
he looks like you know, flashy media class lawyer. So he is a post media columnist.
Yeah, he looks like a pretty cool guy.
Which our favorite type of columnist. He calls himself an employment lawyer, but as we'll see, he's very much not a labor lawyer. He also represents a guy you may have heard of, or at least represented him when he was alive, Jordan Burnt Peterson.
Is that his middle name?
Yeah.
Burnt.
That's so funny. Yeah, I mean, I gotta be honest, I'm not super familiar with Howard Levitt beyond his misadventures. Do we want to get into that at some point, or
what did Howard do?
Okay, so
what did Howard do?
Do you guys remember the fucking Lindsay Shepherd hoax?
No, I don't remember the Lindsay Shepherd hoax. Please, I do not.
She was that TA at Wilfrid Laurier who decided that was a good idea to show her like first year university like grammar class debate on Jordan Peterson on TVO, where he talks about how like trans pronouns are like a communist conspiracy. And her professor didn't like that. And when he found out about it, he met with her and she recorded it and cried and was talking about how she's standing up for free speech, and it went viral. And so basically she sued the school. And so Howard Levitt represents her. And then Jordan Peterson decided to sue the school because, you know, he wouldn't be a free speech guy. He wasn't suing people for calling him Nazis. I just want to quote from this statement of claim that Peterson filed for his lawsuit against Laurier. I would assume Levitt had to sign off on it. So he compares Wilfrid Laurier's contention that he benefited from the controversy and therefore there's no damage done to his reputation is like saying, "Those who survived the Holocaust should be grateful to their oppressors for teaching them survival skills."
Wow.
Very, very normal that, thing.
It's a good comparison, right, guys?
Yeah.
Here's the thing, is we did get Schindler's List and Life is Beautiful out of it, so maybe he has a point.
Yeah.
You know?
To follow up on the Lindsay Shepherd thing is, I went to Laurier, and so I get all the alumni emails where they're like, "Nothing's going on, don't worry, everything's fine." And it was so transparently like a sham, and like it was so obviously not about free speech, to the point that Lindsay Shepherd ended up holding some like Q&A sessions afterwards, and she'd have special guests, and one of the special guests she brought in was Faith Goldie.
No, Faith Goldie is not a polarizing figure because she's a Nazi, but she's hot.
So Howard Levitt is like a huge free speech guy. He wrote a column on how civil liberties are being suppressed on, you know, college campuses. And I just want to read the first few graphs. This is really good. There's a war on civilization throughout North America. It began with a deliberate attack on one of its most fundamental tenets, free speech. Second paragraph. I have had a home in Nicaragua for many years. Nicaragua is currently restive, and its civil instability started, as such movements often do, on college campuses.
Oh no, colleges.
What I find interesting about that is he boasts about, like, owning a summer home in, like, Central America.
It's not weird at all.
Yeah, like, that's totally not something redacted.
He's just out there in white shorts and a Panama hat, you know, doing lines off a boy's ass.
Parody. That is a parody. We have no evidence that Howard Levitt does that.
You mean lines off boys' asses?
Yeah. My point is that Howard Levitt, not exactly a sympathetic guy. And I think there's a particular incident that may highlight that, Eric. Would you agree?
Oh, my God. Well, it's like, it's funny, because, like, Levitt obviously is a very wealthy man. He has very fancy shirts. He also has very fancy cars. And I hope this is the situation that you're referring to. Howard Levitt and his very expensive Ferrari kind of had an incident where they ran into... I mean, it was like one of those immovable objects meets an unstoppable force. He got his Ferrari caught in a puddle under a bridge. And it made the news. Because he had to abandon it. He abandoned his Ferrari in, like, flooded water. It's so embarrassing.
Wait, because it was too low to the ground? It got flooded from a puddle?
The water level was pretty high. I think Howard might have been driving and saw the water and went, I could fucking clear this. This is a Ferrari. And drove a car worth the value of a small house in rural Ontario right into the water and left it there. Because it couldn't get out.
And so the National Post did a story on this. And take a wild guess as to whether they acknowledge that he's also a columnist at their paper.
Oh, they didn't disclose? Disclose that?
They did not.
They wouldn't have the balls to. Like, I mean, I can see why the National Post wouldn't, because, I mean... The headline should read, National Post columnist leaves expensive car in puddle, right? Like, that's what the headline of that story is.
So basically, here's what he says. The water only went up to my tires, but because my car is so low, it really prevented me from moving.
I was right. His car was so low.
I called 911, but because the whole city is using their cell phones, I couldn't get 911. I couldn't get anything.
Because the whole city was using their cell phones?
Reed. What? The police didn't want to come and fucking deal with this bullshit situation.
See, that's the thing about cops, is they'll protect sons of Odin, but they can be counted on to leave these foppish, you know, right-wing millionaire fuddy-duddies in the dust. Which is, you know... So that's the solidarity that we have to build.
This is why
like a cop would beat up John Kay, you know, which is, you know, we have to acknowledge.
This is why I haven't committed to ACAB fully.
Just holding on. That's so funny.
Yeah. Let's fucking read this dumb call. Alex, would you like to do the honors?
Oh, I don't have it in front of me. Hold on. Let me pull it up. Here we go. Financialpost.com. Howard Levitt. Working from home, giving rise to insidious trend. Time theft by employees. And the sub headline is, theft and fraud are two of the few forms of misconduct courts will regularly concede to be just cause for dismissal.
What about murder?
Which is, you know, if you murder your boss, if you're not unionized, you know you're in trouble.
What happens if an employee is taking longer to do their job because they're... Ferrari got Is that time theft?
So I will preface reading this article that I think that a lot of the managerial class believes time theft is a problem because they've been able to work at home for the longest time and they're always, you know, just constantly masturbating to Pornhub or whatever.
Yeah.
and it's like, if I do this, my employees will do this too.
Yeah. And meanwhile, these people need these jobs to live. So they're doing whatever they can to show that they're being productive despite being at home and not having the comfort of a 9-to-5 work day and a nice hour and a half commute and an annoying desk coworker to slow them down by asking them dumb questions about their weekend and stuff.
Also, it's like, I would get the conservative argument too if this applied to like hourly wage workers, but he's applying this to salaried workers as well, where it's like the implicit understanding is that you're paid to complete tasks, not paid to be on the clock, mm-hmm. you know? So, which is why you can give more or less time depending on, but okay, I will continue. Reading this fucking trash. For many employers, remote work is quickly... This is how I imagine him to send. For many employers, remote work is quickly leading to both reduced control and productivity. Like Tim Gunn. He sounds like Tim Gunn in my head. This trend is rising as employees are becoming accustomed to working remotely and realize how little the employer is monitoring their activities. Family member and pets tug at the attention of an employee ostensibly... At work is in scare quotes. There are the possible interruptions of a knock at the door or a call on the landline. But beyond those innocent distractions, generally understood to be acceptable because it is unavoidable, there is a more insidious attention fiend. Time.
Okay, let's unpack that a little. I mean, he says at the beginning that the problem is that employers aren't monitoring people's activities when they work from home. Time theft is like the perfect phrase for this because it's so dystopian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like your people aren't being surveilled enough.
They're not being mm-hmm. controlled either. Because you know, you just get the most out of workers when you micromanage the fuck out of them, right? They need to be mindless mm-hmm. automatons yeah. at work every second of the day. That's how human beings work. Very, very mm-hmm. Perceptive, Howard.
Yeah.
Which reminds me that when this piece was getting dunked on Twitter, a journalist by the name of Tamara Kandekar, she tweeted and said, "This is the same man who suggested on behalf of Chorus PR that I, as part of a three-person team making a daily news podcast, had worked almost 500 overtime hours surreptitiously." What an unbelievably ghoulish column.
Yeah, there's like a lot of issues with it right off the bat. Like one, I mean, it's sort of the premise is flawed just based on the fact that he thinks that the employee can take advantage of an employer in this situation and not the other way around, mm-hmm. right? Like we've all had to learn how to work remotely in these interesting times. I don't have a 9-to-5 work day. I mean, it goes until it stops sort of thing. It just starts and then it stops and your day gets, you know, it ends at the end of the day.
Yeah, if you're doing work, who gives
yeah.
a shit?
Yeah, get the stuff done.
Like, a better metric of time theft, I don't even like using the term because it's just bullshit. A better metric of employee productivity is whether or not they do the job. Like, when you're in the office or you're at home, it doesn't matter. Like, going out for a coffee, like, you got to do human things. And it doesn't really matter as long as you get the work done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, everybody's getting emails now at like 8:30, 9 from like the people that just can't, like they're unable to set those boundaries. And so the entire team then has to respond to them in a timely fashion. Everybody just working all the time.
Well, here's the thing is that if they do it task-based, it feels less like they're renting you. So, and they really want to rent you.
Yeah.
So it feels less like you, because, you know, I just want an hour of your time. That's what I'm paying you for, you know.
It just, I don't know. It's gross. It's gross, the idea that time theft is like a pressing concern. Meanwhile, like people are dying every single day.
The other thing that I will say before I continue is he does make legal points later in the article, which I don't know. I don't have the legal expertise to comment on. He is an employment lawyer. He could be right for all I know. What the umbrage I'm taking with is like the bizarre authoritarian stance, mm-hmm. which I'm sure informs his legal analysis as well. Okay, so continuing. That occurs, time theft, when an employee is not working despite being paid for their time. Sometimes they're doing nothing at all. In other cases, the employee engages in personal activities, but does not inform their employer, or worse, intentionally misleads their employer about their activities and whereabouts. Oh yeah, I was taking my kid outside to the park. Time thief!
Yeah, like, sorry, I was grabbing lunch.
I had to go to the washroom to take a big, fat, steaming dump.
Yeah, that's what worksheets are the best.
Well, you're a time thief, according to
you. Because it's time theft, yeah. And, you know, I would say all work is time theft from the people doing the work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, 100%. But, like, Howard is running off this thing on the premise that people that are working in an office are somehow more productive. And some of the least productive people I've ever seen in my entire life were model office employees, and they just went through their entire life just kind of like fucking around and like finger guns at people and then go for like an 8-hour lunch, and nobody ever, they're like, ah, yeah, it's Mark, who cares. I mean, if you can do it, but like, it doesn't mean like you can only do that from home, you know.
No, my personal experience with home working from COVID is I'm doing more because I have the computer in front of me at all times. And I'm reminded constantly that I can just get this one more little thing done.
That's how it felt for me. I felt like there was less time to like socialize and do stuff with people. Doing chores was just difficult because you have to be sort of like there doing stuff, at least in my personal experience, my job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I feel like I get less done in an office because I'm more inclined to go to the kitchen and commiserate with office workers saying, Mondays!
Garfield. Yeah.
Yeah, we try and replicate that over email, but it doesn't work. I all of my coworkers are much lovelier, nicer people than me. I'm the weird guy that they tolerate, but... but still, there's a place for me there, and, you know, a lot of time theft, you know, gets lost to socialization and human interaction and, you know, making each other feel good in your proximate space that you spend one third of your life in, you know, but how, Levitt does not care for that. Work is for work and not for play.
It's for driving your Ferrari into puddles. Yeah. I think the next graph has the phrase that I find particularly gruesome in this, and this is just... Why don't you take us through it?
It's easier for an employer to discover and monitor time theft in a workplace compared to remotely. In industrial establishments, employees taking a longer lunch or loitering near the punch clock are highly visible. The fucking punch clock. Oh my god. Oh my god!
That's 100% it. Like he thinks work is Sam so and funny. Ralph from Looney Tunes with like the coyote and the sheepdog. Like I haven't worked anywhere with a punch clock except for that magazine that was like that I worked at during journalism school because the boss's son worked there and he would punch in at like 1 p.m. so they put in a punch clock and he just started punching in at 1 p.m. anyways. And they couldn't fire him because he was the boss's son.
I have worked somewhere with a punch clock. And it was a very short-lived corporation in Canada known as Target.
Oh, Target.
100% like probably the worst job I ever had.
It's hanging out near the punch clock. Like, I just can't get over Howard's distorted view of the way the world works.
Well, it shows, like, when the last time he had a real job was.
It's 100% it.
Like, I mean, I haven't worked at, like, a workplace with a punch clock in a very long time. But when I did, it wasn't a punch clock. You know, it was digitized. Same. Yeah.
I have worked at an workplace with an actual analog punch clock when I was a horticulturalist at my college.
I think you should read the next line out.
All right. The next line is, in offices, it's clear when an employee is making their rounds socializing rather than working at their desk.
How dare you?
This mentality that working people are just machines to make profit or make a tax write-off, it assumes that people aren't social, mm-hmm. in that it's wrong for like coworkers to be friendly and to engage in conversations with each other and communicate, right? It's like this like Fordism.
Yeah. I mean, it just also is just so out of touch with what everyone understands work to be. It's like literally the most popular show across all demographics continuing is The Office, because it fulfills the fantasy of actually having intimate social relationships at work, which you never do. No one has social relationships as intimate as the ones that people do on The fucking Office, but people want that out of work, you know? That's something that people want. If they're going to be crushed under capitalism, you might as well get, you know, that's what Andy says in the last episode. I wish, you know, you knew you were in the good old days when you were experiencing them, you know, or whatever.
I mean, it's just clear what side Howard Levitt is on, and it's the managerial side, and I think there's a lot of implicit like bias.
He calls himself an employment lawyer. He should call himself a manager.
Well, I think a lot of this piece is written under the assumption that people are too stupid to be trusted. He doesn't want to give you the benefit of the doubt that, okay, after you do this one errand in your house, that you'll actually go and do your job because you're an adult human being and you have self-control and the willpower to actually do it. He's like, no, these fucking idiots can't do that. Not a chance.
He thinks most people are Homer Simpson.
Yeah, 100%. And like, this is coming from the idiot who drove his Ferrari into a puddle. So, I mean, maybe he's projecting a little bit. I have no idea.
Employees cannot be trusted on their own. They need a oafish fat man in a three-piece suit with a gold pocket watch and a monocle and a top hat eyeing them down every time they loiter at the punch clock.
I like that.
But like Howard Levitt right now is definitely working from home.
100%.
The next one. Yeah. By contrast, remote workers are invisible and far more difficult to monitor. Left to their own devices, they are subject to the allure of a trip to the park, a drink on the patio, or a favorite television program. Before COVID-19, if I were to ask whether most workers would happily accept their regular pay in exchange for staying home to bake a loaf of bread or to scroll through social media, the answer would be obvious.
What?
COVID-19.
These are all, like, the things he's describing are such, like, integral parts of being human.
That I
think it says a lot. He thinks workers should be deprived of them while they are slaving away at home.
But this is also, like, even in the context of a plague, you have to be the most productive you've ever been. Or else you're stealing your boss's time. You know, there's no leniency for anything.
Also, I can only speak for my personal work-at-home experience, which has come to an end now. I should make that clear. But I could not go 14 flights down my office building, go to a fucking bar that's closed anyways, and have a drink on a patio, and get back in time without someone having noticed. Like, I don't know. That's just me. Maybe some people are doing less work where they're less scrutinized as closely where I am, but
yeah, well, no, I think these examples are true because they just ring of a paranoid fantasy of somebody's like, they're stealing all of my money. I'm employing, I am the job creator, and they're taking my money. Their labor is subservient to my managerial prowess. And they're stealing my money, you know, wringing your hands, you know, thinking about all the leeches out there. Feeling like you're a big shark and they're a bunch of remoras.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. COVID-19 has not changed that, and employees now realize they can do just that with impunity. And most employers are not in the business of micro-baking. Micro-baking? Or social media surveillance. Never heard of that. The problem is that, as employers realize they are spending their time on more pleasurable activities than working without fear or reprisal, they will be increasingly motivated to do so. While the productivity consequences are substantial, so are the disciplinary consequences for employees if they get caught. Theft and fraud are two of the few forms of misconduct that courts will regularly concede to be just cause for dismissal. Okay, so here's where he gets into the legal analysis portion of it, which is strange because he doesn't... That very well could be true. That is a true statement. Yeah, if employers do end up, you know, having these screen monitors and they hire, like, a security person to monitor everyone's productivity, then yeah. But I feel like no one would be attracted to work at that company. I feel like the free market would really fail that company if you knew your boss was watching your screen constantly.
Yeah. And also, I don't know if it's actually theft to not do your job. I think it's just not doing your job.
Well, but keep in mind that this is the same guy who thinks it's a totalitarian infringement on free speech for a professor to decide what sorts of things are appropriate for their students.
But like to constitute it as like theft, I feel like it's such a massive, massive stretch. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, I think being charitable, it's a term of art, but I think you're right. It does betray how he feels about this. It does absolutely be like, you are stealing from me, the time provider.
How far are we in this piece? I want it to be done.
For employers, the problem is identifying indolent workers while out of sight. Oh, jeez. For most employees, the chance of being caught is slim. Emails can be answered when away from one's desk, and it can be difficult for managers to determine whether their subordinate slide deck really took 7 hours to prepare rather than three. What the fuck? What does it matter? It got done. Who cares?
You have not adequately
prepared. They did work better, so they should be punished. They should have been doing more work if they finished their work efficiently. Telltale signs of time theft by remote workers include late responses to emails. What the fuck? An ignored audio or video conference. And background noise during a phone call.
I fucking hate this feckless capitalist fuck.
This guy's a fucking time cop.
He's time cop. He's Jean-Claude Van Damme's time cop.
Oh my god. I like how he's describing things that just happen in well-rounded people's lives, like someone else who lives with them doing something in the background, and he's like, that person's stealing time. And it's just like Howard lives a very empty life where nothing interesting ever happens except for him making money. So like, none of this
I like to listen to music while I work. Time thief.
My mom has COVID-19 and she's dying in the hospital. I just had to send an email to a doctor. Time thief.
The terrorists have my daughter. Time thief.
Oh, that rules. Okay, let's get through this one.
Okay, I'll do some lightning round here. In a recent matter, I was advising an employer side cuck, about its long service employee who had been submitting her own timesheets for years. The employer had no reason to distrust the employee or believe she would betray the business. But when performing an internal financial audit, the employer discovered that the employee's gas card was being charged for fuel purchases at least half an hour before her time cards indicated that she had left work. This discrepancy was clear evidence of time theft fraud, and the employee was dismissed for cause. One way to reduce the risk of time theft is to schedule employee breaks and lunches at set hours to ensure employees' expected availability at a certain time, and to require that employees be readily available when contacted during work hours, with the exception that they may be in their quiet home office then rather than somewhere where they might be noise in the background.
It's so embarrassing. It's so embarrassing that he thinks that that's an actual solution.
It's also embarrassing that he thinks that there's a problem. We're living during a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. And, people's behavior patterns change. But, so fucking what? People are doing their jobs. If anything, they're working more than they were before because of this constant pressure to, be on the job while also maybe having your kids home from school. You know, a relative who has COVID, like,
yeah,
give me a break. But,
I mean, that lady was taking taking half an hour of time away from a business every single day for several years. That could be several hundred dollars, Jeremy.
Do you think Howard Levitt has ever represented an employee?
Yeah, Lindsay.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
This is a dude who has his priorities in order.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Employee productivity can also be monitored by comparing the output of their colleagues or their own efficiency when they were at the office. Motherfucker, if you have time to do this as a manager, you are a terrible manager.
Yeah.
When the results of an employee's work product are measurable and appear below the output of others, it might be a sign of time theft. Of course, you're giving tips to the fucking snitches, bitch. Fuck. Of course, the easiest way to identify time thieves is through the use of technology. Many digital collaborative tools will indicate whether someone is in a meeting, at their computer, or, if away from their computer, how long they have been away. For employers, the balance is between strict adherence to work schedules and employee morale. Oh. give them some crumbs occasionally. You know, don't break them. You know, don't break their will. Actually, break their will, but don't break their spirit. Actually, break their spirit, but, you know, give them some vacation days.
Well, it's just not economically efficient for people to die of COVID.
Yeah, it is true. And, I mean,
yeah,
we all love the economy here on the podcast, so... I think
it's very real.
Yeah, no shit.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Shout out to the economy. Yes.
Friend of the pod. Yeah.
Okay, so this last paragraph, he introduces his criticism of his like being a good lawyer, he introduces a counter argument, but right at the end when most people have stopped reading. Yes. Micromanagement and surveillance can result in lower productivity and reduced employee retention, but so too can unfettered freedom. Bitch! What? The key is for employers to develop remote working policies that make sense for their business and are clear in their expectations of remote workers, which includes issuing warnings that time theft will lead to dismissal for cause.
Yeah, that'll really boost morale.
There you go. Fuck. That's the article. That's the time thief
order. Yeah, well, he says time theft 8 times in the article. Well, why not call it moment stealing?
Fellas, I'm the epoch burglar.
We got another shithead lawyer. Alex, tell us a little bit about Bruce Pardee.
Bruce Pardee is a professor at Queen's University. Who I went to Queen's University Law School, formerly the John A. McDonald Law School, and now they've scrapped the name because they've had a few too many of the indigenous students who they want there to get the SJW cucks off their back. They were complaining that, yeah, we don't want to go to a school named for the architect of our genocide, so please, you know, it would be nice if you changed that. But yeah, he's sort of a libertarian type.
Oh God!
He invited Jordan Peterson to campus. He was his official legal liaison because he is the one that gives sort of legal credence to Jordan Peterson's assertion that the bill C-16 trans pronouns would be used to, you know, put upstanding white men like him in jail. You know, so. He is like saying, yes, through this incredibly circuitous path, it's possible that the Human Rights Tribunal will fascism you right into poverty.
and send you to a re-education camp. Yeah,
send you to trans re-education camp where they force you to write pronouns on a blackboard 1,000 times.
So parties, I mean, he very much, I would imagine, runs with the same crowd as Howard Levitt.
Yeah.
Accurate assumption.
Yeah, malevolent PMC right-wingers.
Damn, he is good-looking.
Yeah, no, okay, that's what I wanted to comment on, is he's so what's interesting about him is he always gets a thrall of, you know, young alienated libertarian guys at Queens, and he did this, he's a good teacher, kind of, in like a narrow sense of the word, where he's very competent at teaching basic constitutional law. But I think I wanted to look up, there was one thing on Rape My Professors, which I think was very damning. Let's see if I can find it. Because Bruce R. Party at Queen's University. So he has a pretty high rating overall, 3.8 out of 5. One thing that's bringing him down is one review right at the top, made very recently, October 21st, 2020. His teaching of Law 190 rated awful. Professor Bruce Party is one of the worst professors I have ever had. His opening line was, "This class is and will never be a safe space." He continually harassed and demeaned BIPOC students under the guise of spirited debate and free speech. If it wasn't for his tenure, admin says he would be long gone. This should tell you everything. So that's one. But the rest of them vary from effusive to, you know, he's a good guy, teaches constitutional law, does Socratic method, makes me think, you know, asks the tough questions. You know, which I'm sure are his, you know, Dead Poet Society thrall of, you know, alienated libertarian men that need more rules for life.
Oh, man, that is a beautiful summation of it.
Someone should write a book giving these people some guidance for life and maybe have like a dozen rules or so. And it's too bad no one's done that because, you know, people are just too PC.
Before we jump into this column, I'm looking at a picture of Bruce Party. I actually think he looks a lot like me.
They all look like you, man. Everyone. Every single one of them.
That rules. Okay, so who wants to read this one?
I'll take us through this Bruce Party piece. Fortunately, it's a lot shorter than the Levitt piece. It's titled, "In Universities, the Revolution is Now Complete."
Whoa.
Damn. Maybe I should go back to university.
Oh, man.
All right. And the subhead, "Although Queens will cancel John A. McDonald purportedly on the grounds that he was a racist white man, his demise has little to do with the man himself and everything to do with what he has come to represent."
And a little bit about the man himself, though. A little bit, though.
Purportedly a racist white man.
Yeah, <there's...
laughs> What are you talking about by any definition?
Let us begin. "I teach at Queen's University Law School, housed in Sir John A. MacDonald Hall, named after Canada's first Prime Minister. On September 18th, our faculty board, consisting of professors, students, administrators, and staff, voted 29-3 to remove MacDonald's name from the building. The vote, which also included 5 absentations, is not binding upon the university's board of trustees, which is the jurisdiction to make the call. Queen's principal, Patrick Dean..." I'm sorry.
It's Dean Dean.
That is some nominative determinism right there.
Wait, so is he Dean Dean?
Nah, he's the principal.
But they changed the title.
Is he the dean or the principal?
He's the principal. Queen's principal.
What's the difference between the principal and the dean?
Maybe they changed it because when I was there, it was Dean, not Mark Walters. What was it? Mark Summer. I forget his name, but they called someone a dean. I don't know if there's a difference between a dean.
They changed it because it would be too silly.
Because having Dean Dean would be dumb.
There. All right. I cannot verify this, but Queen's principal Patrick Dean is expected to make a recommendation to the board this week, and it will vote on the question soon after. McDonald is likely to become another casualty of the cultural revolution currently underway in Canada. At universities, that revolution is all but complete. Who controls the present controls the past, Orwell tells us. And who controls the past controls the future.
Why does he keep doing song lyrics? He controls the present now, controls the future.
You know who controls the future, the past, and the present? Time thieves.
Time thieves. Oh my god.
Time thieves.
Oh, shit.
Holy shit.
All right, moving on. Although Queen will cancel McDonald, purportedly on the grounds that he was a racist white man, his demise has little to do with the man himself and everything to do with what he has come to represent. One of the tasks of any revolution is to tear down the narratives upon which the previous order was built. McDonald himself is less important than how we regard him. When any historical figure is canceled, the real targets are the attitudes of the living. What?
He knows John A. McDonald is dead. So why is he saying this?
Nobody's told him yet.
Shit. Man, is he on Twitter?
Yeah, he's Twitter at Party Bruce. I know because I was calling him a hack fraud bigot for a while.
Facts will not matter. McDonald is accused, among other things, of forcing indigenous children to go to residential schools and letting Aboriginal people on the prairies starve when the buffalo disappeared.
He did, though. Yeah, like, he did. What are you talking about?
No, the facts don't matter. The facts...
Those are facts.
They won't matter, though. It's fine. He prefaced it. The facts don't matter.
The historical record says otherwise, guys. Residential schools already existed before McDonald came to power, and they did not become compulsory until the 1920s, 30 years after his
death. Okay, that's fucking wrong. Yeah. That's straight up wrong. They became compulsory in the 1890s, like just 3 years after McDonald's prime ministry
ended. I was wondering about this.
Yeah, I mean, he was the one that was hell-bent on putting a railway through Canada and, you know, running roughshod over treaties in order to do so. You know, while aid was occasionally administered to indigenous people, it was not at, you know, any sort of significant level to prevent their starvation.
Yeah, but he didn't forcibly remove anyone from their homes personally.
So, good guy.
No, he didn't. No.
Bruce gets into that. When the famine struck, McDonald sent aid to save the indigenous lives and was condemned in the House of Commons for providing too much.
Yeah, no, that's fucking straight. What? That's fucking wrong.
Looking after people was not something governments commonly did until the welfare state emerged well into the 20th century. Oh, fucking great.
McDonald provided aid to indigenous people in the same way that George Bush provided aid to Hurricane Katrina victims, you know. Technically, yes.
Oh, I love this next line, because it's really ahistorical. In fact, McDonald was enlightened for his time, but that will make no difference.
Well, it's...
No, that's the opposite of truth. He was known as notoriously genocidal for his time. Even for his time, he was a horrible racist.
I love
racist.
This fucking idea that, oh, everyone back then was like this. So this guy, and like he did like a few, like I'm going to cherry pick these things that were good because he sent anything at all. And that makes him good. Like, you're wrong.
Yeah, when you're looking for something to justify why the place that you work gets to keep its name, which for some reason seems very important to Bruce Party.
I guess he's afraid that if, you know, the law school goes, they're going to topple all the 1,000 other John A. McDonald statues in Kingston. And it's going to be... There's too many John A. McDonald statues in Kingston to fucking topple. It's like the fucking Hydra. If you topple one, two more crop
up. But honestly,
up.
There's so many different people from Kingston that you can make those statues into. The SNR guy. The SNR guy again. Gord Downey.
Gord Downey. Yeah.
That's three people. The SNR guy twice and Gord Downey one time.
So, in fact, McDonald was enlightened for his time, but that will make no difference. The test for tearing down statues and canceling historical figures, whatever the fuck that means, has become whether their values and behavior conform to modern progressive sensibilities. The only monuments to the likes of Castro, Lenin, and Mao have a shot at satisfying that criterion.
This sounds like so many columns we've read already. The communists are taking over college campuses. Antifa is going to behead your grandma. Canada is great. Why do you hate Canada? Why are you attributing negative motives to a national hero? It's all the fucking same. But this guy's a lawyer.
Yeah.
This guy's a lawyer.
If these guys... Sorry.
But this is an opinion piece, you know, that's not about the law. which is weird that he's writing it. I guess he was just really shook up because it's happening in on his home turf.
Aw.
And
sounds like he needs a safe space.
He does need a safe space. His class is not a safe space, so he really does need one. Yeah, I think they turned this into a free speech issue, but what it is, it's an aesthetic issue. Is like, you don't like the aesthetics of like a different name because it prevents something else. You know, the institution won't fundamentally change because you have a different name on the outside. You think it will, but you know, it's just that you don't like the look of it. You know, what does that say about you?
And yeah, like guys like Party, and I'm painting with a very broad brush here, so forgive me for this, but guys like Party grew up thinking that Johnny McDonald was a hero because he was one of the fathers of a confederation. So Canada, I guess, lacks any sort of person to build a narrative around. So they built a narrative around this guy who ended up being a real piece of shit. And now people are being a little bit more honest about it and going, hey, this guy's kind of a piece of shit. Maybe we shouldn't celebrate him. And guys like Party cannot handle their heroes being taken away from them in any capacity. Yeah. These columns, all they do is scream like, my fifis are hurt. If Bruce Party could see how stupid he looked for writing this thing, he would probably resign out of shame. Unfortunately, I feel like people that spent this long telling people how to think are incapable of self-reflection. So I think we're stuck with them.
Well, because they rationalize it, because they are the most rational. This isn't an emotional issue. It's not that I am upset. It's that you are destroying free speech by removing his name. His name was once here, and by taking it away, you are making me marginally less aware of John A. McDonald all the time. So
I personally don't understand why these activists don't just fight John A. McDonald in the battle of ideas. Like, why are they afraid of his arguments?
Anyways, let's keep going through this turd palace. Despite the facts, McDonald will be called racist because that is the conclusion modern academic theories demand. Critical theory,
also known as scholarship.
Yeah, fuck those nerds. Critical theory and its offshoots, including critical social justice and critical race theory, have helped establish the present era of, scare quotes, intersectional victimhood. The more disadvantaged groups you can claim to belong, the more disadvantaged groups you can claim to belong to, the more oppressed you are. How is that?
Okay, that he's just plagiarizing Jordan Peterson. Yeah. Like,
I think there's also an interesting instinct where he says if there's a large academic consensus on something, it should be met with immediate suspicion. I think because he's also, if you follow his page, I think he's like a herd immunity truther or something like that as well. You know, he has a bunch of like choice COVID takes.
Cool.
Like a
these guys are all anti-maskers.
Yeah.
You know, rev up the economy and let's go.
But he is the expert that will tell you to not trust the experts. You know, he's like a John Stossel. You know, don't trust the experts. Trust me, I'm an expert. You know, that sort of thing.
He's just he's got alternative facts.
Yeah.
Critical theories are anti-Western doctrines premised on the idea that Western civilization consists of abusive power relationships between identity groups.
I'm against this ordinal point.
White men, especially if they are straight, are by definition privileged and therefore racist. McDonald, as a dead white man who brought into being what is now regarded as an oppressive Western nation, is self-evidently culpable.
I don't think it has anything to do with him being a white man.
Yeah. Those who wish to preserve McDonald's name and legacy may believe they can defend Canadian tradition and values, but they may be too late. Rome cannot be protected from the Visigoths once the Visigoths run the place. The non-woke are no longer shielding the old culture, but attacking the new one. At the law school, I'm the barbarian, not the other way around. He's been reading Rate My Professor. After all, I was one of the only three people to vote against the McDonald motion. Aw. For decades, universities that have been inoculating students with the ideology of critical theory and its offshoots, which are now ascendant inside government, mainstream media, unions, tech companies, corporate boardrooms, and public schools. In an extreme example, ex-Twitter CEO Dick Costello tweeted recently, "Me first capitalists who think you can separate society from business are going to be the first people lined up against the wall and shot in the revolution. I'll happily provide video commentary. Ignoring the threat that universities have long posed is a mistake."
That is an awesome quote from the former Twitter CEO. I did not, like, that is the one thing I learned from reading this. Yeah, is that the former CEO of Twitter is kind of cool.
He's kind of based.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, this column is us witnessing the world pass Bruce Party by. Like, this is like a very archetypal kook column.
And like, he's giving the Tommy Lee Jones No Country for Old Men speech.
Yeah, you know? Well, it's like the Abe Simpson where he's yelling at Homer. He's like, "I used to be with it, and then it changed. Now what's it is scary, and I don't like it." Like, it's like the world has changed, Bruce. It's either adapt or step out of public discourse, because you're not with it, bud.
Or scaremonger so that laws don't change to accommodate minoritized people. or just scapegoat a microscopic group of people so you can continue pushing the needle back on your conservative whims, you know.
Ignoring my own fraudulent claims of victimhood.
And just, you know, straight up saying straight up just telling unfactual things about John A. McDonald when saying that you represent the side of facts. You represent the historical record. So he makes a bunch of contentions in that article, a bunch of very disputable, easily disputable claims about John A. McDonald. And, like, you can find opinion pieces also from the National Post that directly dispute claims made by Bruce Party in this opinion piece. So the fact that, you know, he's confident that he's part of the facts revolution is just such a keen example of this narcissism and this strange bubble that he's in. And, you know, I don't know where he gets this shit from that he thinks that everyone is fucking Marxist, because he teaches at Queen's Law, which in my experience is pretty fucking center right, if anything. You know, that they tend to tack there. You know, they're fine with the gays, but they don't like it. Man, do you want to know about an experience I had at Queen's Law that sort of represents the color of the atmosphere there? One time, an indigenous student leader, part of the student government, tried to do smudging ceremonies at an adjacent room, like half an hour before student government meetings. And there was this massive libertarian backlash to it, saying that they're forcing people to do religious ceremonies because if we opt out of it, then they'll brand us as unwoke. And it was bizarre. And so, like, the indigenous student leader had to call off the smudging ceremony because it was causing too much controversy. I don't know if Party was anti-smudging, but his cohort of libertarian fuckboys certainly were.
Well, that's interesting, because there's another example of free speech being impeded on a university campus.
No, but because it's... One, they called it religious speech, which is, that's a very disputable claim. And two, they weren't forcing anybody to do it. It was voluntary. It was just bizarre.
There's been a number of controversies at Queens. I remember these from when I was working in the news industry, and there was incidents of homophobic note being posted inside a dorm. And I remember this from 4 years ago. There was like a costume party with all these like offensive racist costumes. And
yeah, there was racist costume party where they, I think some kids dressed up as some white kids dressed up as the Viet Cong, and also Mexican immigrants, which they conveyed by wearing sombreros, mustaches, and prison jumpsuits. So I think that appeared on a Vice article. Yeah, so people... But that's... Yeah, so that's the atmosphere that he's around at Queens. So how does Bruce Party surmise from that atmosphere that there's this goddamn epidemic of SJW PC cucks you know, threatening academia.
It's just like there's just the mildest criticism of his hero figure for completely valid reasons, and he just, that's too much for him to handle, I guess. He has to opine in the National Post.
You've gotta read the last paragraph because it quotes my prime minister.
All right, so last graph. Last week, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney made this error when he called intersectionality a kooky academic theory. Social justice academics predictably condemned Kenney for his ignorance. But of course he was right. In a pluralist liberal society, which Canada once aspired to be, there are few ideas kookier than intersectionality. Kenny's mistake was not calling it out, but in failing to take it seriously. Kooky academic theories are among the biggest threats to freedom, prosperity, and rationality. Henry Kissinger, oh God, among others, is credited with the observation that university politics are so vicious precisely because the stakes are so small. That line is funny only if it is true.
Wait, how responsible is Henry Kissinger for Kent State?
We now know that it is dead wrong. Just ask John A. All right, that's it.
I was going to say, that line is not funny.
Yeah.
Because the stakes are so small, but that totally negates the entire premise of your thing, which is the stakes are huge, which is why it matters that John A. McDonald's name is being taken down. So you're admitting that your own gripe is petty in the last paragraph of the article. Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to see that point to him. It's like, yes, you're right, Bruce. Okay, let's pack it all up.
It reminds me of that Leslyn Lewis column, which is probably the craziest thing we've read on the show, where at the end she's like, don't worry, none of this is going to happen because we're going to build a movement and you're going to support me.
You're going to vote for me, please.
And it's like that, like, okay, so what were you rambling about for however many hundred words?
Yeah, because what they're doing is they're trying to, you know, wrap their idea up with like some sort of call to action at the end. And instead, what they're doing is undermining the entire premise of their column. And it's so much fun that it happens this often that we can point at several examples of it happening. This is a terrible column. This is a man with tenure.
Yeah. Well, I would say that both these takes remind me that, first of all, lawyers are terrible writers. Second of all, it brings me back to when I was covering court at the Medicine Hat News in pre-COVID times. And you would see a case where the person was so obviously guilty and the lawyer knew it. So they're just making the most like ridiculous, like nonsensical arguments that are just there because like their client doesn't want to plead guilty.
Mm. Yep.
And that's sort of what these columns remind me of. Just really, really laughably weak arguments from guys who are obviously somewhat intelligent. I mean,
yeah, well, that's the other infuriating thing is Party, not unlike Dr. Oz, actually is a fucking, you know, scholar and has credentials and has shown that he can be a smart person, which is why it's infuriating. So it shows that this grift is more intentional, you know. He has some meta-awareness of what he's doing, which is why it's doubly as infuriating, because he should know better.
Lawyers, can't live with them, can't live without them.
That's a great way of wrapping it up. Of these two lawyers, which one did you find more offensive to read today? Jeremy, you go first.
Which one was I more triggered by?
Which one owned you more?
I would say Levitt, because he's not just some kooky law professor. He's actually a practicing lawyer who advises companies on how to suck the living soul and grind their employees to a pulp.
Yeah.
And the clear like implication of his column is that the problem is that, I mean, he even says it, that employers can't surveil their employees.
Because of laws or whatever.
He's like Lionel Hutz.
Because of like lack of productivity, you know, the employees might be demotivated by constant surveillance, you know.
But I just picture Howard Levitt showing up to court without his pants on. I wasn't in comparing him to Lionel Hutz. I'm not.
Well, the thing is,
judging the quality of his legal advice,
he lost them in the puddle.
His pants just were too low, and he got them caught in a puddle. They got flooded, and he had to leave them in the street.
Fuck, he needs flood pants.
Yeah, everything would be coming up Howard then, you know?
That's nice. Well, what do you guys think?
Oh, yeah, Levitt for sure. Just because Levitt's talking about actually owning people. Whereas, you know, Party's just like, I'm racist grandpa is no more, and I'm sad now. I feel that's much more benign than talking about how to actually more effectively, yes, as you've said, suck the life juices out of people.
I think I agree with both of you on that. Like, I find this John A. McDonald was actually a good guy discourse really annoying because it's just blatantly untrue. And also, like, don't have heroes, people. Like, you're like 50, don't have a hero. It's embarrassing. But this Levitt piece is like, if those ideas really caught on, that could cause serious damage to people's lives. Marino, what did you think? Exactly. Marino, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's Levitt. The Party article only really matters to a bunch of like grandpa ass boomer, and like it could be even people our age with boomer values and overly too much concern about identity politics and crap like that. But like everybody works in this sick capitalist machinery, and you can see like employers latching on to like the whole surveillance idea and downloading programs to monitor employees in this sort of dystopian world. I've read articles about companies propping up in this pandemic time, so the implications of that are way more important to me.
Yeah, and the fact that he doesn't take a neutral stance, he basically endorses the use of surveillance so that employers might more effectively wring their employees of the sweet spice, of the sweet nectar.
Every last drop of productivity belongs to your employer. Remember that.
It turns out labor was the true adrenochrome.
Oh my god, that is the best way to end this. But before we go, we should talk about some good things that we read that weren't a travesty to the written word. Jeremy, have you checked anything good out this past week?
There's a hell of a newsletter for people who live in the Calgary area or are interested in the next year's City Hall election there. And that would be my newsletter. I write for an outlet called The Sprawl. Go to sprawlcalgary.com and sign up for my newsletter.
Marino, do you have something that you would want the general public to read other than these two columns that we just got through?
Well, I remember reading something about something about a sunshine list of sorts, but I suspect that might be someone else's pick. So I'll just talk about, well, Remembrance Day was recently here, and there was a lot of good articles about poppy discourse. And I think Davide Mastracci's article on Passage was really informative. He talks about how sort of like kind of basically a rule that TV journalists and the mainstream media have to wear a poppy. Gets into the Royal Canadian Legion and just this idea of Canadian nationalism that's kind of an imposition, a cultural imposition, more than Marxist University, certainly, I would say. And I would go check it out. He explains it all better than I can at readpassage.com. They rule.
Mm-hmm.
Also subscribe to their newsletter.
Yeah,
because I write for that too.
I actually read that article too, and what the other funny thing that happened as a result of that article is they got into a Twitter screaming match with Dean Blundell.
Yeah, it made Dean Blundell so mad, and he just kept posting and getting like perfect ratios, like zero likes, zero retweets.
Beautiful.
But it's like, Yeah, people were posting, "We live rent-free in your head, Dean Blundell," and he kept posting, "I own David Mastracci's soul."
Oh, it was so great. I can't believe I forgot about that fallout.
The fact that Passage was the vehicle to get Dean Blundell attention gives me hope for new media in Canada, actually. Especially because they were willing to publish me as well, and I guess that's my recommendation. It's like been a week and a bit now since I wrote something, but I wrote a column about why we should be pushing for a post-media sunshine list. But I mean, if you wanted to read something that wasn't about post-media, there's a great article in the New Republic called The Town That Went Feral, and it's about a libertarian utopia that was overrun by feral bears. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
I love you guys. I love to be on here. I listen to my podcast. I'm doing another call to action because I'm a genius. It's House of Decline.
Yeah, that is something good I listened to this week. House of Decline, their episodes come out on Sundays, and they are very funny and insightful and just kind of like the best podcast. It's like, you listen to it and you're like chilling with your two friends.
Yeah, we're like, if Cumtown was worse, that's us. If you want to listen to a worse Cumtown, you'll really love House of Decline. But thank you for having me on. I really do love being
please
here.
Please come back. Every episode you've been on so far has been a blast. I think we could make it 3 for 3.
Mm-hmm.
You're our law
person. Get another lawyer commentator on there and I'll be all over it.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye.